Thank you, Paulino, for inviting me to give this presentation. It's a real pleasure, and thank you for all the organizers for setting this up. So I'll get to it then. So as you mentioned, the title of my talk is Transforming Oneself Through Painting. But before I get to the actual topic of my presentation, I just want to give you a bit of a background to kind of give you an idea of where I'm coming from into this specific topic. So I'm working on a project right now, just a personal project, called Situated Mind and Artistic Creativity, which is funded by the Finnish Cultural Foundation. And the main question is, how does the creative mind work in making art? And at least in some circles, this question has been answered from a kind of internalist point of view, where the cognitions and the emotions and the perceptions and all the processes that go into making art are considered to be something that goes on in the artist's head somehow, or at least reducible to something which might be considered to be like a internal cognitive system, or if we want to go down like a physiological route, then we look at brain states and processes and try to identify what happens in the mind and so forth to explain creativity. So in this kind of picture, the non-neural and all the extra bodily elements that are present in making art are basically seen as peripheral sources of input to some kind of internal system that does all the like the heavy work, all the significant stuff. Well, my approach is actually completely opposite, and it could be called this externalist point of view, where the basic idea is that the creative mentation and creative activity in a broader sense should be investigated and studied as a situated phenomenon. And I guess the most simple way to kind of say what this means is that all these mental phenomena are fundamentally dependent on the environments where they occur. So all the resources that are in use, all the tools, all the social kind of resources as well that go into making art, they're relevant in a very fundamental way to the mentation at play in creating art. So from this starting point, my project tries to look a little bit closer into all the different factors and mechanisms that are involved in this kind of situated or distributed framework or network that underlies creative mentation. And through this point of view, I also want to analyze certain specific cases of art making to shed more light on those processes, and by doing so also develop the theorization that's involved in this kind of situated approach. Okay, so that's my current approach to research and what interests me. And I think this can be called like a pilot study in this project. I wrote this article with my colleague Joel Kruger on artist studios, how artists engineer and painters in specific engineer their own workspaces to support very specific operations and affects that are constitutive of making art or the creative process. So we looked at how artists use music, how they use other artists' artworks, and how they use certain kinds of memory aids inside the studio space to support and also enhance their creative mentation. But for today's talk, I'm gonna go a little bit further back in my background, and which is to the book that was already mentioned here called Affect and Artistic Creativity. So here my basic question is also quite simple, but also very broad. Why do painters paint? Well, obviously, painters paint for many reasons. They paint to solve visual problems. They want to participate in a historical tradition of painting, whatever. I mean, the reasons, the motives are very, very many. But there's one reason that I think hasn't been discussed that much yet in this kind of creativity research, is that painters also paint in order to feel certain things. The painting process itself enables them to feel things that maybe they otherwise wouldn't even be able to experience. And some of these feelings, the basic point is, like the title says, things you paint to feel. And some of these emotions and affects that I discuss in the book are feelings of absorption, of aesthetic resonance, which means that something in the work itself feels right, and the maker, him or herself, is very connected to the painting. There's a harmonious connection to what they're doing. Also feelings of aliveness or vitality, unity, connectedness, all these different kinds of feelings that are enabled by the painting process itself. And to make sense of these kinds of affective states, I've used theorization from both psychodynamic and developmental psychology on the one hand, but then also contemporary philosophy of mind and emotion on the other. So I've tried to bring these two different traditions together to say something interesting about painting and the affect involved in the painterly process. So it's against this background that I want to say something about transforming oneself through painting today. And I'm going to focus on one particular report of making art, which had very significant self-transformative and existential reverberations. So this case study is about Marion Milner, who was a British psychoanalyst, also a writer, and what she called herself as a Sunday painter. So she was really interested in painting, and she wanted to kind of learn to paint better. And this whole project of hers amounted to a book called On Not Being Able to Paint. I think she first published it under the pseudonym of Joanna Field, if I recall correctly. So this book is kind of like a self-observational report or description of this whole process of her trying to learn how to paint. And it's very vivid and almost, you could say, a colorful account of what went on in this project. So content-wise in the book, she reflects on her developing understanding of form, of content, of color, expression, all these, you know, familiar things people deal with when they paint. And she investigates these from a psychoanalytic point of view. But what I find really interesting in her account is the affective and also the existential ramifications or the import of these two aspects of painting or creating art more generally. These really kind of rise to the foreground of her experience as her project develops. So I'll say a few things about her creative journey to kind of illuminate what this kind of self-transformative process was like and what its existential import was. So to start out, Milner basically felt very frustrated and kind of, she didn't know what she was supposed to be doing when painting. I think she might have had this traditional view of painting as trying to depict things as realistically as possible and kind of be truthful to nature in a kind of conventional sense of depicting things. So there was this kind of overt reliance on conventional notions of beauty, proportionality, perspective, and when she tried to do things the right way, they led to kind of lifeless results in her own experience. So as she puts it in her pictures, the world was quite clearly and precisely there, but still remain utterly remote and meaningless. So to get rid of this kind of approach to painting, she decided to pursue what her eye really liked. That is to draw without predetermined conceptions or certain depicted aims related to these traditional or conventional ideas of beauty and propriety. So she started out by doing these kinds of free drawings to get her going. And through these free drawings, she made several important discoveries about painting or making art, and also about herself. One of these discoveries was that these drawings that she made sometimes appeared to be better ordered holes and even more expressive than those with clearly planned intent. So these kinds of spontaneous drawings somehow had a more coherent structure to them and had a more kind of lively feel than those pre-planned pictures had. And to kind of produce these kinds of vital pictures, she realized that she had to get into this mood of reciprocity, where the eye and the hand were free to respond spontaneously to the emerging marks on the paper. And this is something that's really common in many artists' descriptions of their creative processes. They try to get into this kind of dialogical relationship to the materials that they're working with, where actually the painting itself or the work itself is given a certain kind of agency in pushing the creative process onwards. So you have to listen to the painting or be very sensitive to what the painting has to say and what it suggests and so on. So this is kind of what she meant by this mood of reciprocity. And finally, she discovered that there was this certain existential impact in her drawings. So she came to realize that some of these drawings were actually really complicated reflections on the central problems of being alive, or just plain being, especially how to bring one's imaginative capacities into a creative interplay with external reality. Now, this is something that's really informed by psychoanalytical thinking about this distinctions between subject and object, inner reality and outside reality, and how these intermesh and how they should kind of be brought together in imaginative and creative ways. And also this kind of overcoming of these dualities is really important, this kind of thinking. So here's a picture of one of her free drawings. I'm afraid it might not be all that exemplary, because in the book she traced the drawings, the original drawings, with pen and ink, so they're really kind of like simplified versions of what her original drawings were like. But anyway, for example, by looking at these two jugs that she was drawing, she found that the outlines between these two objects were not inherently clear-cut or absolute, so they kind of start to intermix somehow in her perception. And she just described how the edges between the two jugs began to ripple in relation to one another. And another kind of perceptual discovery that she made was that the colors were also prone to kind of merge fluidly and freely when they were freed from the bondage to natural appearance and outline. So this kind of idea that freeing oneself from a habitual mode of perception could lead to interesting ways of seeing things. You know, also ways of seeing things that vitalized one's own sense of being. So this can be kind of broken down into the statement that for Milner, two kinds of modes of experience or experiential worlds emerged from her drawings. So one of these worlds was the world of common sense and clear distinctions and kind of where things are really fixed into place. So just basically a world in which things are separate and stay the same. But in addition to this kind of world, she discovered this world of change and development and much more fluid boundaries, a world where things continuously intermix and merge with each other. So I guess that the first kind of mode of experience is what would basically apply to most of our habitual perception. We make clear distinctions between, we see things as separate and so forth. But there's also a kind of underlying other level of or mode of experiencing and also perceiving that is at work in our perception. So when she discovered this world number two, she also felt this kind of dim fear of losing her hold on the solid ground of reality, where things just, you know, don't stay in place and they don't have their fixed meanings or positions and so forth. But eventually she just became really fascinated by this question of boundaries in creativity when she overcame this tentative anxiety about fluid boundaries. So in her book, she talks about boundaries between external objects of perception, but also the boundaries between herself and others, or self and other more generally, and also between internal and external reality. And this led to what I think is, or can be described as, an existential transformation. And this is how Milner herself describes some of these moments of kind of feeling and being differently. So she says that breaking free from convention always seemed to be accompanied by a feeling that the ordinary sense of self had temporarily disappeared. And these kinds of shifts from ordinary consciousness consisted in feelings of blankness, no differentiation, and elation, among other things. So these gradually gave way to an experience of a new, maybe a more harmonious and unified way of being for her. I think this is a really descriptive quote that gives you a good idea of what she experienced. So I'm just going to read it. It was the discovery that when painting something from nature, there occurred, at least sometimes, a fusion into a never-before-known wholeness. Not only were the object and oneself no longer felt to be separate, but neither were thought and sensation and feeling and action. All one's visual perceptions of color, shape, texture, weight, as well as thought and memory, ideas about the object and action towards it, the movement of one's hand together with the feeling of delight and the thusness of the thing, they all seemed fused into a wholeness of being, which was different from anything else that had ever happened to me. Okay, there's quite a lot of stuff going on here. There's feeling and perception and action and things and memories and thoughts, but I guess you probably get the idea of how significant this experience was for her. So through this kind of own personal experience of transformation through painting, she gradually also began to kind of reflect upon this experience and to champion the transformative power of art making. And she proclaimed to have discovered a different sense of self and a new way of being altogether. So this also indicates that one's self and one's being in the world are really intimately connected. They're difficult to pry apart, or maybe we can do so in some kind of analytical sense, but from this kind of phenomenological point of view, the two sides of the same coin. And artistic creativity can impact on both of these aspects simultaneously. So this brings Miller to conclude that ultimately then it's ourselves that the artist in us is trying to create. And if ourselves, then also the world, because one's view of the one's view of the one interpenetrates with one's view of the other. Okay, so we have this description now given by Milner. This really interesting, I think, process, gradual process of change, affective change, and also existential change. But I think the interesting question is, how are we to make sense of this? What kind of concepts or theories can we use to really get to the bottom of what's going on here? So the question becomes, how should we conceptualize this affective transformation? So if we take into consideration the fact that this experience incorporated the body, the self, and the world in various, very significant ways that can't really be grasped by more traditional or established notions of, for example, emotion or mood or bodily feeling, then we have to look elsewhere for the appropriate conceptual tools. So I'm just going to briefly say something about emotion and mood, for example, in the way they're defined in philosophy of motion. So if we think about bodily feelings, then we usually think about just things we notice, changes in our body, for example, the hair standing up on the back of our necks or our hands getting clammy or things like that. Emotions, in turn, are feelings that we feel towards things. They always have an intentional object, so to speak. So when I'm happy about something. When I'm angry about something. They have an object that they're directed towards, other than the body itself, as they are in bodily feelings. And in moods also, we can say that they have a certain kind of directedness, but the object of moods is very vague or diffuse. So if I'm feeling angry about nothing in specific, at the world in general, then I'm in a mood of this kind of angry mood. But it doesn't have like a specific object at that particular point. But I don't think any of these concepts work to explain Milner's experiences in the best possible way. So what I want to say is that we could conceptualize these as existential feelings. So I borrow here from philosopher Matthew Ratcliffe's theory of existential feelings, which I think can help make sense of Milner's case in specific, but also creative transformation more generally. So Ratcliffe draws on Husserl, on Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty, these classical phenomenological thinkers, to argue that existential feelings are background feelings that structure experience as a whole. They're also called feelings of being in his terminology. So when I said that emotions and moods have an intentional object, these existential feelings are pre-intentional. They structure our intentional experience. They're somewhere in the background. They're more all-encompassing. The ways we find ourselves in the world in specific situations. And they open up like a space of possibilities and things, and ways that things can matter to us. So, in short, they disclose the world in a pre-given, all-encompassing way. They provide us with a changeable sense of what is real, what matters, what's possible, what's significant, and so forth. So, as these kinds of feelings that are in the background to structure our experience as a whole, existential feelings tend to elude conscious awareness and precise verbalization. They might be kind of hard to grasp or articulate, to give words to, in the same sense that we can say, oh, I'm feeling a certain emotion right now, for example. We can put that into words maybe a bit more easily. So when we do describe these feelings, they're usually talked about as all enveloping terms. For example, as feelings of unfamiliarity or aliveness, being at home, being at one, and so on. And what's also interesting is that in these kinds of descriptions, the self and the body and the world tend to be interchangeable. So when I talk about an existential feeling of strangeness, I can say that I feel strange, but I can also say my body feels strange, or I can say the world feels strange. These can all refer to the same existential feeling. So while these existential feelings usually operate in the backdrop of our conscious awareness, they can become consciously salient. And this usually happens when they undergo very significant shifts or disruptions or alterations. So we're not usually aware of the sense that we inhabit the world. I mean, we take it as a given because we're so used to it. I mean, this is the way things are disclosed to us. And the world provides these and those opportunities for us, and we feel in this and that way. But when this pre-givenness undergoes significant changes, we become aware of what we had previously and what the new existential feeling is. So as Radcliffe puts it, a notable change in the feeling is felt as a changed relationship to the world as a whole. So we can think of maybe like religious conversion experience in these terms. So, as Radcliffe says, a world that is drained of life can be shaken up so as to reveal a different and perhaps wider space of possibilities, something more, something greater. And something of the opposite sort maybe happens when we become ill or, for example, in cases of depression, where we lose all hope and things all of a sudden lose all significance. The affordances that are given to us by the world are not there anymore. We don't even feel that we can achieve pleasure in the things we used to be able to find pleasure in and so forth. So this is a very fundamental shift in one's whole sense of being, one's feeling of what the world has to offer and what is possible. So applying this to this idea or this practice of painting, I think that when Milner writes of her emergence into a new world of fluid boundaries and so forth, into living essences and wholeness and all those things she said, I think she's describing a significant shift in her own existential feeling. In this sense, her shift from ordinary consciousness amounts to a new sense of reality, or if we want to put it in phenomenological terms, to a new way of finding oneself in the world. But that's not all there is to her story or her process of painting. So these aren't just like random, temporary, episodic shifts in her sense of the possible, in her feelings of being, and they're not arbitrary alterations. Paulina referred to this idea of temporality in her opening talk, and this becomes really strongly apparent here, that this whole temporal process of undertaking this project of learning how to paint and how one changes through that rises into the foreground here. So there's this kind of sustained reflection and interpretation that she practiced throughout the process of learning to paint and figuring out what all these different shifts in her experience entailed for her being more generally. So as Radcliffe will put it, when we reflect upon changes in existential feeling, we come to recognize that there's a question to be addressed regarding the nature of our sense of reality, a question that cannot be asked if reality is taken as given. So Milner's painting disrupted what she had taken as given previously, her sense of reality as a whole. And as I mentioned, she reflected deeply on these existential perturbations and changes that she went through during her creative journey. So this is one way to interpret the whole book on not being able to paint. And that's how I've read it, as this as a record of these kinds of existential deliberations and changes. So after she had overcome these initial fears that she had about fluid boundaries and so on, she found that these disruptions to her habitual sense of reality to be very liberating and vitalizing, and also desirable in a sense, and pushed her to question the very world that she had previously inhabited and taken for granted. So ultimately, we can say that she was very captivated by the possibility of establishing a new way of being altogether. And she realized that once these existential things did become consciously salient, they could also be significantly reshaped through different activities, including artistic work. So this gives rise to the idea that these kinds of episodic shifts in existential feeling can encourage one to actually consciously cultivate a new existential orientation as a whole. So try to make these ways of experiencing things, or this particular way of being in the world, into a more stable and permanent orientation to the world. So I guess that the concluding point is that painting can have a profound transformative effect on the overall sense of being that the artist has. And in this sense, the painting process itself can serve to scaffold or to enable, to support, and to regulate and indeed transform the artist's existential feelings. So if we look at painting in this light, we can also say that the existential feeling itself that the artist has can become one of the main objects of artistic creativity. I mean that it becomes that which is worked on in painting. So it's not only working on the artwork itself, it's working on oneself and one's existential orientation to the world. So I just want to give you one final example of this kind of self-transformation through art. So this is a philosopher and painter, and I also think composer, Michael Krauss. So he tells of his kind of initiation into the world of painting through a personal experience. So he had this experience when he was viewing his friend's abstract paintings. There's a series of large abstract paintings that he was looking at. And then all of a sudden he experienced myself in the space of the work instead of looking at it. More than that, I experienced an interpenetration of myself in the space of the painting. In that space, I suddenly became much more highly visually sensitive to spatial relations, coloration, and more. Okay, so this is a bit similar to Milner's kind of experiences of fluid boundaries and oneness and so on. But Krauss says that this very special experience implanted in him an inner necessity to begin painting himself. That really got him going. And he says that these interpenetrative states continue to inform his ongoing artistic experience and practice. So he continues to value these states in his work. So he says, as a consequence of my non-dualistic experience, I now experience more clearly, more expansively, more richly, more perspicuously. Such changes in my ways of experience in turn affect what I produce. What I produce has affected my ways of experiencing. I think of my art making as a process in which who I am is enriched and transformed. In short, my art production fosters my self-transformation, and my self-transformation fosters my art production. So there's this two-way process continuously going on here in his artistic practice. So just to finish up, I want to quote another psychoanalyst, George Hogman, who has written several books, actually, on artistic creativity. So he says, like breath or sight, the creative act is inseparable from self. And over time and effort, it becomes the artist's primary medium of self-experience and self in relation to the world and other people. And he continues, artistic creativity is not just something that the artist does, a pastime or preoccupation. It is a way of being in the world and of experiencing one's inner and outer life. So I think it's pretty safe to conclude that creating and transforming oneself through art may actually become the work of a lifetime. So I'll end there.